This is Betty Turnell speaking for the Decatur Public Library. Our guest today is Mr. Charles E. Lee. Well, Mr. Lee, have you lived in Decatur all your life?
Yes, I was born in Decatur on January 30th, 1896, and of course I've been living here all the time since that.
Well, you really had a long and, I'm sure, an interesting life here. Could you describe the city the way it was when you were a boy?
Quite different from today, because that, of course, was horse and buggy days. The automobile was just beginning to be known as something that would run in my early time. And, of course, it wasn't until about 1917 or 18 that Mr. Ford made the Model T Ford, which in turn put America on wheels, as they said. So that was quite a different setup than what we have today. As I've said sometimes to young people when they were touring the Governor Oglesby Mansion, which was built in 1874, at that time there was no electricity, there was no radio, there was no television. Automobiles were just starting. There were no airplanes flying. So that the time then was a much different style of living than what we have today.
Do the young people you talk to ever wonder what you did for fun when you were a boy?
Well, we had quite a lot of school children come through the Oglesby Mansion, and we didn't get into much of that. But of course, we had numbers of things that we could do. We played more games, I think. We did more outdoor exercising, like skating, things of that sort. One thing we did then, which few of the children do today, we walked. And if we needed to walk a mile or so, we walked a mile or so.
In a way, a healthier life than today, wasn't it?
From that standpoint, it was much better, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, what schools did you attend?
My first elementary schools were the Wood Street School, which was located where the Mary W. French School is now, on the same identical site. Then I graduated from Decatur High School, and then I graduated from Millikan University in 1917. Our class then, of course, was the wartime class, and after that I served for some time in the United States Navy, in the United States and in France.
Well, you must have had some experiences there.
Well, there again, that of course being in 1918, I was on a naval air station in the south of France. The planes, most of them, were really flying boats. They were used for submarine patrol. And interestingly enough, the top speed of what we call the HS boats was 90 miles an hour. And they were powered by a Liberty motor, which was a 12-cylinder motor in line. So it was quite a different situation in those days than what we've had, of course, with the advent of airplanes that really did a lot more than they did then.
But you were not on the plane, you were on a ship?
Were
you on the plane?
No, on a station.
On the station, on land.
The station was what we called an assembly and repair. Mm-hmm. It assembled the seaplanes and repaired those that needed repairing. Mm-hmm. And as I recall, we operated 14 submarine patrol stations in the southern part of France.
Well, I'm sure you must have had some exciting experiences there. Did you stay there until the armistice was signed?
I was in France at the time of the armistice, yes, and then came back to the United States in January of 1919.
And to a very jubilant country after the close of the war.
Very much so, yes.
Well, then did you decide to go into your career as an attorney?
Yes, I even to the point of having taken an examination for ensign in France and passing it, I could have taken a commission. But I had wanted to study law, my father being a practicing attorney in Decatur, so I decided that I'd come back to the States as soon as I could. And upon getting back, I entered my father's law office and studied there.
So you got your law education by practical experience?
That's right. Mm-hmm. In those days, if you had an A.B. degree from college and studied law in a law office for 3 years and then passed the examination, you were certified as a practicing attorney, and that's what mm-hmm. I did.
Well, I'm sure you were qualified with the experience that you had behind you in your father's office. You in a way, it was a tribute to your father that you decided to go into law.
Yes.
You knew the kind of occupation you were getting into.
That's right. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm.
How has the practice of law changed during your career?
Well, the technical practice of law was still under what was called the common law procedure, derived from the English practicing. We've changed a good many of the things since that time. And, of course, the practice of law now involves things that we didn't have anything to do with much at that time, which would be the traffic violations and that sort of thing, which take up a lot of the time of the courts.
And all the government requirements, legal
requirements. Oh, yes. All of the regulations that they have, it really ties things up in knots.
Well, what type of practice did you go into, or was it general?
In the early days, interestingly enough, those were the days of prohibition, when the United States had an amendment to the Constitution forbidding the sale and use of alcoholic liquor. So, in that case, whenever there was an alleged violation, there would be a warrant issued under a city ordinance, under a state law, and under a federal law. So it was quite a proposition.
Excuse me, do you mean anybody who was caught drinking mm-hmm. alcoholic beverage?
Well, they were selling it or,
having
it in possession,
uh-huh.
yes.
Well, that...
And of course, that was something which was so foreign to the idea of Americans in wanting to run their own lives. Mm-hmm. That it didn't last too long, and of course later it was abolished and the amendment was knocked out. But I had made up my mind at that time that in that type of criminal procedure that I didn't want to continue with that. So most of my practice in the years in between here now has been probate, which is handling estates mm-hmm. and matters of that sort.
Were there any especially interesting cases that you recall or that you could talk about?
Well, there's just one that's not too interesting, perhaps, but under a mechanics lien law, anyone who furnished material in this construction of a house had a lien claim against the house itself for the money that they put in. In the case in question, which was a woman who lived at Mount Auburn, Illinois, and who had a house built there. She had paid the contractor, and he didn't pay all of the supply men. The Lyon Lumber Company had a claim of about $3,000. The time within which they could file their claim legitimately had passed. And then they came up with the idea that one stick of wood, which was the threshold of a door, would revive their claim. Mm-hmm. And of course, that meant that we had to have a continued litigation in circuit court, then to the appellate court, and finally to the Supreme Court, which of course sustained our claim that did not revive their particular claim on the mechanics lien. It was interesting, and of course expensive.
An ingenious way of trying
yes.
to reopen the case. Were you involved in any state legislature at all, or did you have any...
I was a member of the state senate uh-huh. from 1929 to 1933. As a Republican, ran for re-election in 1932, but that was a time that the Depression was on. People were mad, they were broke, they were out to defeat President Hoover, and they elected Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And in doing so, most of us who were Republicans were being defeated, as I happened to be.
maybe it was a difficult time anyway during the Depression. Was the state legislature involved in some sticky problems then?
It's some rather interesting things that might be worth speaking about. At one time, I attended a dinner in the YMCA, which was the state meeting of the veterans of the foreign wars. I was sitting alongside the commander, state commander, a lawyer from Chicago named Cone. As we were sitting there, he called my attention to a young man who was coming up to the head table. He said, "I want you to meet this fellow." And up came a very fine-looking young man. Mr. Cone said, "Slee, I want you to meet Mr. Oberta." Well, that didn't mean too much to me, but it turned out that Mr. Oberta was associated with the gangsters in Chicago. He was known as Dingbat Oberta. During the time I was in the Senate, I sat next to Frank McDermott, who was a Democratic senator from the Stockyards District of Chicago. His wife was very much disturbed at that time because Frank was running for re-election. And the man who was running against him was this Dingbat Oberta, who'd been nominated by the Republicans. And Mrs. McDermott was very much disturbed because she thought they might take her husband for a ride. Mm. As a matter of fact, they didn't, and he won. Mm. But it's rather ironic. The people in that district, the Republicans, could nominate a man who was known as a shooting gangster and who wound up himself being taken for a ride and killed.
Well, but still, it's rather reassuring to know that he didn't get elected.
That's right. You have to give credit to
right.
people for that.
People were at least aware of that. Do you have any other of these cases or experiences?
Well, since we're talking about the people in Decatur, another one was rather interesting as it ties in with our American system of politics. I was in the office of Clarence Buck, who was Director of Agriculture of Illinois, on a matter. And when I started to leave, he called to me and he said, "Senator, who is J.T. Ward over your way?" Well, the wheels went around in my head a little bit, but I couldn't come up with anything. I said, "If you'll tell me in what way you're interested, perhaps I can come up with something." Well, he said, "We're going to appoint a superintendent of stallion registration for the state, who'll be in charge of registering jacks and stallions, the horses and mules of the state." Well, that then began to click. And I knew of a man that we called Tobe Ward, who had been a stockman, that is, for horses and mules, for a long time. So I said to Mr. Buck, "Well, if this is the man you're talking about, and I'm pretty sure it is, I would say he's one of the best qualified men I would know." The next statement will be just a little rough, but it's what he said. He said, "Qualifications, hell. Who's behind him?" Well, I happen to know, for some reason, that the men who were the head men in the Millican National Bank had an interest in him. Whether he owed them money, I don't know. But when I came back to Decatur, I talked to Mr. The president of the bank and the vice president of the bank at that time. J.M. Brownback was the vice president, and I told him what the story was, and I said, "It looks to me as if a little push in this matter will get J.T. Ward the appointment as superintendent of this particular department." Well, the upshot of that was that they got busy and I guess put a little pressure somewhere, and he was appointed. But I thought that was very interesting in connection with our American system of politics. Not that the person is the best qualified, but who's behind him.
Right. It is an illuminating look at American politics,
isn't
it? And probably hasn't changed much since that time.
Still, politics is jobs in America, and it's still that way.
Right. Well, we know that you were also mayor of Decatur. When was that, Mr. Lee?
I was appointed as mayor in March of 1936 to succeed Harry Barber, who had been elected mayor but had resigned. At that time, under the commission form of government with a mayor and four commissioners, when there was a vacancy, those men who were, as these four commissioners were, in position to name who should be the mayor, approached me, and the upshot of that was that I agreed to take the position and was appointed. I served the 3 years and a little more.
Now, did you tell us what years those were?
From 1936. That was March of 36.
Okay.
So that I ran then for election in 39 and was elected and served the 4 years.
Well, very good. Well,
and during that time, I had the interesting experience of having been elected president of the Illinois Municipal League, which is the overall league of cities and villages in Illinois, and then for 2 years was president of the American Municipal Association, which was a national group of 42 state leagues of cities. And that, of course, was quite an interesting thing also.
And an honor, too.
Yes.
Have those awards. What issues were facing Decatur when you were mayor?
Well, we had, at that time, the Supreme Court was operating under the theory with reference to Negroes that they should have separate but good
equal
rights. That is, on the things that should be done. So we had the bathhouse on Lake Decatur had just been completed, and understandably, the Negroes wanted to use the bathhouse, and that was beginning to cause some difficulty. So I got together with a committee from the colored group. Dr. Ellis, who was a very fine doctor, was the chairman of the group. And we looked around and decided that we would build a separate bathhouse conforming to the Supreme Court's definition in the location where the Decatur Yacht Club boats are now listed along the lake. The ground in question had been city ground, had been turned over to the park district. We approached the park board, and they said, yes, that sounds all right, we'll go along with it. But later, when it developed that the location was adjacent to some of the most exclusive residences of town, the Country Club outfit and the East Moreland, the park board changed its mind and decided against going ahead with this, which was a very unfortunate thing because we had developed a very good relationship with the colored population. And that was one of the early times when race questions came to the fore.
Well, did they just disband the idea of the bathhouse?
Nothing further was done then about trying to do anything.
Well, that's too bad. Of course, later, the civil rights movement came in and changed
the whole background then, yes,
right.
And rightly so.
Right,
so.
Right.
Those of us in Decatur, as I look back, had no race questions. I had colored children in elementary school, in high school, and at Millikan, and we thought nothing about it. Mm-hmm. They were our friends, and we went right along. But, of course, that wasn't true of everybody.
Were they on athletic teams?
Yes. Fred Long and his brother Harry at Millikan were outstanding athletes. Fred was a big man, probably weighed 250 pounds, and served as center on the football team at Millikan for some years. But that was during the time when the team would go on a trip to other spots to play games. The hotels would not accept a Negro at all, and they had to make arrangements for him to be taken care of in private residences, which shows what the situation was there with right. reference to races. Now that, of course, is a good many years ago.
Right. Were there any other special issues that you recall as when you were serving as mayor?
Well, we had, of course, plenty of things to try to do. I was superintendent of the police department. Not long after I was sworn in, I found out that the police department had never been given a chance to get special education. What we did, I guess, in those days was to take a young fellow and give him a billy club and a gun and a cap and say, you're a police officer, without very much background. So we got started and began to have some of our men take the special courses at the Federal Bureau of Investigation in Washington. We had one man take the special fingerprint course, Gerald Sheehy, and in turn, when he came back, he was able to handle the fingerprint situations. Then on the traffic division, because of course traffic was quite a problem in those days, we had it shaped up so that all of the members of the traffic division were given a chance to go to Northwestern University for the special traffic courses which they had there. And I was very glad that I had some opportunity to do something about that.
Yep.
That time, for about 39 or 40, was when parking meters were just beginning to start. Mm-hmm. And we had the newspapers suggested that we put parking meters around their office building, which we did. But it didn't do very much for the problem because there were too few of them. So then the problem was presented, what should we do more to control the parking in the downtown area? Because then, as even now, a lot of the parking spaces in downtown are taken up by the people working downtown to the exclusion of the people who want to come downtown to shop, and that is still true. So we decided that we would go ahead with the proposition. And a group of downtown merchants asked if they could have a meeting with me, and I thought they'd have a committee of maybe four or five. Turned out there were 23 of the outstanding merchants of downtown that met with me that time. And they were pretty hot under the collar. Several of them, Bill Van Law, who still has Van Law's Carol's store, Harley Gregory, who was president of the First National Bank, several others said they were going to take the matter to court. Well, I explained to them what the deal would be.
Excuse me, you mean they didn't want to have parking
meters? They didn't want parking meters at all.
Mm-hmm.
I explained to them what the deal would be. The parking meter company would put the meters in on a 6 month trial basis. They would give us 25% of the gross income for that period. At the end of 6 months, if we didn't like them, they would take them out. And as I explained it to this group of men, I said, this looks to me like it's a deal to find out. I said, we don't know, you don't know, and nor do I, what the parking meters may do. Well, the interesting thing about it was that they worked at that time.
Uh-huh.
And the same men that had been so much against it, all of them came to me later and said, well, we were wrong, and we were glad to work along with you.
Uh-huh.
You get a lot of experiences when you're sitting on the mayor's chair in any city, and of course, was true indicator.
Well, I'm sure of that. You mentioned a few of the people who were prominent indicator or had a deal at one time or another. Are there any others that you want to mention, or anybody that you worked with or that you recall?
I was thinking of the woman who was in charge of the American Red Cross in Macon County during the First World War, Inez Bender.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember the work that she did, which she put in a lot of her time and effort at very efficiently. But I remember the epitaph that was applied to her in the newspaper after in later years, where she was designated as a useful citizen. To me, that's a pretty good definition in America.
Mm-hmm. guess it's a real honor, even though it doesn't sound very flowery. It really is what makes the country work, isn't it?
It is. Yes.
Well, you told us a little bit about the problems that Decatur faced when you were mayor. What do you think the problems are today?
Well, of course, the basic problems are pretty much the same in one way. I mean, you have your traffic troubles, you have your other crime deals, which we had at that time, not as much as now. One thing we didn't have, and that's rather interesting in my thinking, during the time I was at Milliken, graduating as I did in 1917, there was no drug problem. There was very little alcoholic problem. Probably some of the boys would get out and get a little beer occasionally, but not to any great extent. And to me, there, of course, there was no drug problem in the high schools or the elementary schools at that time, which I understand and we rather generally know is one of the big problems today. So we had quite a different deal then. We didn't have to face up to the drug problem, or again the alcoholic problem that they seem to have today.
Of course, we didn't have mass communications the way we do today, so that ideas didn't spread as fast. Perhaps it's the idea that people learn what's going on other places that brings about...
Well, of course, in those earlier days, we were practically confined in our major sources of information to the newspapers, mm-hmm. because we didn't have radio, we didn't have television, which in that sense is quite a different background than what we have today.
Well, I know that you haven't retired from the practice of law. You're still in business. But do you have any recommendations for people who have retired?
Well, yes. I tell people, whether they've retired or not, the older people, and I've said this consistently where I have occasion to advise with them, when there's a death of the husband or wife, the survivor, in my opinion, should stay in the home location as long as they can. I have no feeling against nursing homes, but I do feel that as long as older people can stay under the same conditions that they had before, they're better off.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you are in a very favorable situation since you, in a sense, are self-employed. It's the people who are forced to retire, I suppose, that face problems when they're suddenly cut off from what they've been doing all their lives and have to take care of their leisure time. Or
it's quite unfortunate. I've had the privilege of being a member of the board of the Commission on Aging, which is a branch of the city set up under the Office of Aging here. And I happen to be on the committee that is now faced with the running the downtown drop-in center, which is, of course, a senior citizens deal. And I know that the problems are pretty definite in approaching the ideas of senior citizens. I do not favor, of course, in my case, I can practice law as long as I think I'm anyway useful. But I think it's been a great mistake to have mandatory retirements at 62 or 65, because we lose a lot of good service on the part of the men and women who would be in those positions. But that seems to be the way it's set up, and of course the younger generations coming along feel that they should have jobs also, which they're entitled to. It presents a problem.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the young people. Do you have any suggestions for young people today?
Well, if I get, and this isn't a matter of being a pessimist, but if I get the idea of most of the men who are in position of employing young people, too many of them are interested basically in how much they're going to make and how much vacation they're going to have, and not so much interested in doing the work that really is required. That seems to be the major complaint that many of the business people that are employing younger people have today. And of course, many of the young people today, on matters of salary, figure they're going to have to start out at the same salary that perhaps their father was making after 30 or 40 years. So it's a problem there. It's just what's going to work out in that respect.
What do you think about the future of Decatur?
I'm bothered, I think most of us are, about the downtown situation. Whether or not the final word is going to be that the big stores will all leave the downtown area, I don't know. Sears has talked about it, but so far they haven't left. Montgomery Ward say they're going to stay. But we've got a lot of vacant spaces downtown. My own feeling is that as long as I can buy what I need downtown, I'm going to do that, mm-hmm. rather than to go out to the separate malls, mm-hmm. wherever they may be. But it presents a problem, and I know that city officials, chamber of commerce men, all that sort of thing, are working with the idea of trying to improve the situation, and I'm hopeful that it will work out better.
Well, if we just get enough of those useful citizens who will pull together, maybe we can bring it through.
I'm not, as I say, not entirely pessimistic. I think it can be done. It may necessitate a different approach to filling up the downtown spaces for stores and so forth. But I think if we use reasonable intelligence, we can work out something that will be a great improvement in the downtown area.
So in general, you are really not discouraged about the life today and perhaps even somewhat optimistic about it, right?
Yes, I am that with reference to the future of America, very definitely. I don't think we're on the downhill grade. And in Decatur, I think we can work out the problems here to much better advantage than we have so far.
Well, very good. Thank you very much for sharing your reminiscences with us. You certainly had a long and interesting life, and you too should have an award as being one of those useful citizens who has helped.
Well, I have engaged in a good many of the civic organizations, mm-hmm. as I've come down the line. Yes, it's and I'm glad that I've had some mm-hmm. chance to contribute mm-hmm. a little. I remember a quotation of Abraham Lincoln, which he said that he hoped after he was gone that the world would be a little better place because he'd lived in it. And I hope sometimes that's true so far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'm sure it is, and I'm sure Decatur is a much better place because you've lived here. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the reminiscences of Mr. Charles E. Lee, former mayor of Decatur. This is Betty Trunell for the Decatur Public Library.